We've got microphones, we've got headphones, we have wonderful panelists. What the hell? Let's do a show.
And some news.
And news. That's right. We have topics to talk about. We'll do a show. Good morning, all. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel segment for this Thursday, the 30th of October. Delight to have you all with us. We really, obviously, you know this. I hope you know this, of how special it is to have you listen to us and to be a part of the program. You can always be a part of the program by writing to us, panel at wamc.org, panel at wamc.org. We have a terrific group this morning. Let me introduce them to you, and then we will get started and talk about the news of the day. We welcome Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, joins us. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Oh, good morning, Joe. It's great to be back. Congratulations on the fun drive. And just reminding everybody, tomorrow is Halloween, so please be careful. Watch out for the trick-or-treaters and wear your reflective clothing, and have a wonderful evening.
Yeah, it'll be
it's the least scary night of the next week.
Well done. Well done. That's right. That is very true. You ain't seen nothing.
Yeah.
We also welcome Albany Law School professor Sarah Rogerson. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
I remember in 2016 we went trick or treating with the same family that we decided to watch election results with. And I'll say one of those nights was much shorter than the other.
Yes.
It was a load your children in the vehicle and go home and start to plan for what to tell them in the morning situation.
Right. Yeah. Well, yes. And so we'll touch on some of this morning, more in the political sense, less in the Halloween sense. But if you want to throw that into your comments, please feel free. We are also going to be joined by Heather Mulligan, the CEO of the Business Council of New York State, who has checked in but will be here in just about 10 minutes or so. All right. So we'll get started. And don't worry, Heather will catch up very quickly with what we are talking about, and we will bring her up to date. So last night, Washington, D.C., the city, the ellipse. Vice President Harris delivered her closing campaign argument. A spot where she did it was chosen to draw a sharp contrast with Trump. It is where he spoke on January 6, 2021, and told people to follow him after saying on Truth Social that it was going to be wild. She used the setting to make the distinction between her vision of the country and his. It came just 2 days after Donald Trump made his closing argument in New York City at Madison Square Garden. She could have given the major speech in any of the 7 battleground states, and if she wanted to deliver it in the nation's capital, she had her pick of historic locations. But Harris specifically chose the ellipse just south of the White House, the exact spot where Trump attended the infamous January 6th rally that launched hundreds of his supporters on a violent attack at the Capitol building in an attempt to overturn his election loss. And with the White House as a dramatic backdrop, she used the setting to make a sharp distinction between her vision for the country and the former president's. Donald Trump has spent a decade trying to keep the American people divided and afraid of each other. That's who he is. But America, I am here tonight to say that's not who we are, Harris said. America, we know what Donald Trump has in mind, more chaos, more division, and politics that help those at the very top and hurt everyone else. I offer a different path, and I ask for your vote. But even with Trump top of mind, Harris's challenge was to draw a contrast without ceding control of the conversation of the former president. After Hillary Clinton's loss in 2016, some Democrats thought she focused too much on Trump in the campaign's home stretch. And just a few days ago, Future Forward, a major Super PAC supporting Harris raised concerns that zeroing in on Trump's character was not the most effective closing message. So with that, we go over to our panelists. And Bob, what do you think?
Well, I mean, it's kind of hard not to raise the character issue. It is all about character. I mean, you can't see a starker difference between these two candidates, which for some of us listening, I'm sure it's hard to understand some of the current polling, because when you listen to one candidate who's making outlandish attacks, is supporting speakers on his stage that are frankly vile. You know, I'm not sure I agree with the position that we should be ignoring Donald Trump's character. I thought her speech was exceptional. It was presidential. I thought it continued to draw a sharp line in my mind between the two candidates. So she did what I think needed to be done. I think she needs to continue to push. I know she's in three swing states today, and I think she continues to need to outwork Trump. Joe, I'm gonna go on record right now. I think Harris wins, and I think she wins by a larger margin than the polls are talking about. But it's all about the ground game. It's all about people getting out to vote. It's all about us taking time to talk to our neighbors and family members and remind them what's at stake. But at the same point, I think there are enough trends that I'm seeing that I feel that with more hard work and a sprint to the finish, that things are going to be okay.
Yeah, I think these speeches are really meant to get the base motivated to get out the vote on Election Day. Obama won because he had a historically unprecedented, savvy, specific field game. This is different because Trump has a savvy, I wouldn't call it sophisticated, but an insider view of how to disrupt this election. Right. So the ground game is going to have to be smarter and savvier than it was certainly last election cycle and back when Obama was elected. I understand the critique about character. The swing voters don't care because we're so calloused as a country at this point about our leadership that it's about the positionality and it's about your personal, I don't want to call it agenda, because a lot of times it's like needs, right? Like, how much are groceries going to cost me this week? Can I take my kids to Disney World? Can I buy a truck? Can I, afford to send my kids to summer camp so that I can have an undisrupted work schedule in the summer, because we woefully undervalue and underfund care work, and it hurts our economy primarily for women. So I men still run this country, and the things that men care about still run this country. And so character of leadership is not one of those things that many men in leadership care about. And Donald Trump did a lot of that. But Elon Musk isn't helping things. And many, many other men behind them. So I appreciate all of the work that other men are doing to dispel rumors and different things. But all you have to do is look at the Proposition 1 chaos to see how easily distractible people are from the truth and reality and words on a page. So these speeches are great for getting people excited who are already excited about the platforms or positions that people are rolling out. But they're not I agree that in order to get capture more moderate voters, there's a more nuanced message that happens in other spaces, quite frankly.
Sarah, for the listeners who aren't from New York, can you talk a little bit about Proposition 1 and what's going on?
Yeah, so there's a misinformation campaign that's very well, I wouldn't say very well organized. Some of the signs are in Comic Sans font, for example, which really isn't the one you pick when you're trying to persuade people that your message is serious. But
when you have the word comic.
Yeah, I mean, the Times Union has been doing a good job of trying to combat misinformation, but it's about reproductive freedom and making that creating New York State constitutional protections for reproductive rights, which has been turned into all kinds of things, anti-immigrant messaging, anti-trans messaging, under the guise of parental choice and saving girls sports and keeping illegal immigrants, quote unquote, I don't use that term, undocumented, but that's what's on the signs, from getting rights. So if you look at the text of the proposition and what it actually does, and if you read the news and pay attention to explainers that people are putting out into the public, it's not what the misinformation campaign is making it out to be, but people are having to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars to combat that misinformation and that contortion of facts around one ballot proposition in one state. It's happening everywhere.
It is happening everywhere. And some, I mean, have multiple, I mean, so many ballot propositions that the voters are going to, you know, it's going to be very confusing for them as they try to work their way through these various propositions and figure it out and what's right and what's wrong for them.
It's on the level of, like, they're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats.
Right.
It's at that level of misinformation.
Correct.
And vitriol.
Heather Mulligan joins us. She is the CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Sorry I'm late.
That's all right.
We knew it's not the first time.
You reported in and told us exactly when you were going to be here, and you're exactly here when you said you would. So we're thrilled that you're here, and thank you very much. I think you see where we are in the conversation. Anything you'd like to add?
I do, and I was listening on the way in, which I usually do. And just so people know, the reason I'm late is because my dogs are getting a bath this morning, and I had to drop them off. Something I forgot as I was planning my morning, and then I realized at the last second. So that was fun.
Pet bathing, very important.
Yeah, they smell pretty bad right now. I'm not going to lie.
Dogs on the farm.
Yeah.
So it's safe to visit your house again, is what you're saying.
It is right now. Yeah, they're not home right now. So, no, my dogs are very friendly, but they also really enjoy the outdoors, and they like to roll around. And, you know, dogs are dogs. But I was listening, and, you know, on the closing argument piece, I think I heard a lot of what Sarah had to say. And I think it's right that the closing arguments are for the base. They're not necessarily to try and convince last-minute swing voters. If they were, they would be in swing states, right? They'd be in the swing states. But I don't think that either closing argument is going to make a difference, even though there is a tremendous gaffe, obviously, at Madison Square Garden. That I don't know how they did not. Someone on the campaign staff should be fired for allowing that comedian to come on. I mean, this is not a joke that was out of the blue. It was something he practiced before. So they would have had knowledge. They're definitely trying to walk away from it and roll it back. But they're just trying to keep their base, and she's trying to keep hers.
It was a love fest, Heather.
It was a love fest. That's what I hear. I do not agree, though, that Harris is going to win a landslide. I think if she wins, it will be by the smallest, tiniest of margins. I have a very good friend who is on the road right now, who's a reporter for a very prominent publication, certainly not a right-leaning publication by any stretch of the imagination. This friend is not right-leaning. And the assessment from Wisconsin and Michigan the blue wall states is that she's not going to win either state, and she's going to lose those states by a significant margin. Which, so, you know, maybe the comments at the Love Fest will influence the outcome in Pennsylvania, which certainly is going to be very important. But I am very concerned. In fact, the assessment from this reporter was not only was his prediction was not that that Harris was going to win by a squeaker. His prediction was that Trump was going to win by a lot. And that is from someone who's on the ground in the swing states. So I also have been in conversations with the heads of state chambers from other states. We talk all the time, and we do, you know, basically straw polls on who do we think is going to win. And the most she did early on have the vote, but she does not anymore. So sorry to be so sobering.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be a landslide. I'm not saying that she's going to get 80% of the vote, but I think that she's going to do better in the swing states than what's being published right now.
I'll let the audience chew on all of that for a few moments as we go over to the BBC News. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 30th of October. And we appreciate you being with us, and thank you very much for your input. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Anything anyone would want to say about where we left the conversation before the break?
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple more things to toss out. One, Biden just needs to be quiet and, you know, let things go. Don't give any bulletin board material that will take the wind out of Trump's team's sort of self-inflicted wounds. And Heather, I think your point about what happened in Madison Square Garden, that was all self-inflicted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also think that Harris should be prepared to declare victory early, because I think that's what Trump is going to try to do. I mean, if you start to look at some of the statements that are coming out about elections in Pennsylvania right now, it's the classic playbook of trying to say that it's corrupt. So that there's cheating going on when there is no evidence of that. And frankly, I think that the DOJ needs to be prepared to do its job.
Yeah, I don't know what the margin of votes is going to look like in Pennsylvania, but under their ballot rules, they can't start opening the mail-in ballots until Election Day, right? Unlike Florida, which they open them as they receive them. So there's, you know, that's going to cause delay. And if there are, and I again don't know what the numbers look like in terms of the number of mail-in ballots in Pennsylvania, but if it's close and there's enough ballots, you know, that you're within the margins, then it could significantly delay calling of that state.
Right.
Yeah, especially where the smaller rural counties, which traditionally vote red, are going to come in sooner than some of the more urban areas, and certainly the mail-in votes.
Yeah, that's strategic too.
Right.
Claim the lead early.
Yep. And then claim that they were robbed. That's so.
Yep. So I was listening to Michael Smirkanish, who's a POTUS. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a man in the middle, I guess. He's and he's in Pennsylvania, and he said that a lot of the I don't know if it was him or a guest said a lot of the problems in counting the urban areas in Pennsylvania have been resolved. Like, they have a new methodology, they have a way to make sure that there's not huge delays in the counting of their urban votes. So I'm not sure what that, you know, what that system
specifically
is.
Specifically in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
They have worked very hard on the system in Philadelphia to make that a more rapid system.
Yes.
But it's the outlying counties, the suburban counties, and quite frankly, the blue suburban counties that of not only Philadelphia, but also of Pittsburgh. Harrisburg.
Yeah. In Erie, too.
And Erie, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's go to some letters. We go to Linda. So what exactly does Proposition 1 do? I agree there's a lot of information out there about its intent and how it will affect others. However, when I read the text of the proposition, it's really not making a lot of sense to me. If you can water it down to the point where it can be understood easily, I would appreciate that. Otherwise, I have no idea what it says. And I'm going to just skip the proposition altogether. Too ridiculous to even bother with.
Well, the text reads, adds anti-discrimination provisions to state constitution, period. Covers ethnicity, national origin, age, disability, and sex, including sexual orientation, gender identity, and pregnancy, period. Also covers reproductive health care and autonomy, period. That's what it reads. There is a website now that I just stumbled on this morning, but it does contain helpful information. It's called whatisnyprop1.org, the number one. And it boils it down. It says, get the facts. And under what does Prop 1 do, it says Prop 1 will ensure our reproductive rights and fundamental freedoms, including abortion, are protected from government interference, keeping the power with New Yorkers and not politicians permanently. It also protects New Yorkers from government discrimination because no New Yorker should be taken advantage of by those in power. And the reason why they can claim that is because it would amend the state constitution, which is way more powerful than any legislative item in the state of New York. So it doesn't change the law. It changes the way that the rights are protected.
Anybody want to add anything to that?
Sure. I mean, I think just to elaborate, it means that a future legislature could not alter by passing a bill and even having it signed into law rights in violation or in conflict with what is in the Constitution. The Constitution, anything that provides greater protection under the Constitution can't be undermined by state-level legislation. And certainly under federal law, the state has the ability to afford greater rights to its citizen than the federal government. It cannot provide lesser rights. Mm-hmm. The ideal thing would be the protection of reproductive rights in the U.S. Constitution, because then no state could undermine them. And that is sort of like the whole problem that starts with the Roe decision and keeps going, right? It didn't start there. There's a whole lot of other cases that relate to what is a protected right under the U.S. Constitution. But so this would provide it at the state level. And I know there's an argument that the state has already enshrined Roe versus Wade in statute, and I think maybe even in the Constitution already. But this goes beyond that in terms of anti-discrimination.
Jeremy writes to us and says, I do think the appeal of Trump is so simple and it baffles me that it continues to be so mysterious on the left. I work with a young person of color who said the other day that he knows Trump is a racist and a bad dude, but he's a businessman and will be better for the economy. People are concerned with the price of groceries, gas, and rent. It's that simple. How I wish this wasn't the case, but it is. Meanwhile, on the other side, question for the panel. Why isn't there more media attention on J.D. Vance and his lack of experience and qualifications for the job? The odds of Trump, 78, and already too exhausted to complete interviews, finishing a full term, are very small. Can we talk about that for a minute?
I'm just going to say this, and I know, like, we're getting to a point where it really does matter, and it was, I think, more pronounced when Biden was the candidate. But people vote for the president. They don't vote for the vice president. That's just not, you know, it's just not how, you know, elections work. The Vance argument is, he hasn't been, you know, as fully vetted as, a presidential candidate would be. But there's also the challenge that he is very, very good on his feet. He's very good in a debate setting. He's very articulate. And so taking him on head on as if he was the candidate, I don't know that that would be particularly helpful. In fact, it might actually get some of the swing voters to go over to the Trump side. So focusing on, you know, sort of the gaffe master himself, Trump, is probably better in terms of, you know, highlighting the differences.
There is we could talk about a lot of the ads, but there's one that's been running on and on, and I've now watched it several hundred times. So
I'm sorry.
I've taken it in, but it's from the Republican Jewish Coalition, and I don't know if you've all have seen it, but it's an ad that is called Amen, and it opens with three older women with stereotypically Jewish speech patterns seated in a booth. The booth is in a place called Jaime's Deli, a real place in suburban Philadelphia. They're sipping coffee and talking about current events. And the script reads, "Did you watch the news lately? Israel is under attack, anti-Semitism like I never thought I would see. Did you hear about Samantha's boy, Max? No. He got spit on just walking at Penn. I mean, that's scary. Well, what about Kamala? Ugh. Busy defending the squad. Oy vey, says woman number one. You know, Trump, I never cared for, but at least he'll keep us safe. Mm-hmm. I never voted Republican in my life, but I'm voting Trump." And the third woman said, "Amen." So that's the ad.
That explains the Trump for Peace sign I saw this morning.
Correct.
I've got a couple of them in my neighborhood.
So, $15 million ad
Piece
campaign.
Of what?
Yeah. P-A-C-E.
Oh, sorry.
And I just thought, and the other thing is that at the bottom of the at the end of the ad, there's a check. It's their check for the coffee, and it's, you know, an astronomical amount of money. And then it simply says, "Donald Trump will keep us safe." And so you sort of get what the writer of the letter before was talking about, of we're going to make this about pocketbook issues, but we're also going to talk about safety. I thought it was an interesting way to go, because quite frankly, in a non-swing, we live in a non-swing state, obviously.
Yeah.
So these are the ads that we're seeing. I wonder what impact they have.
Yeah, and the ads are much worse in the swing states. You know, a couple things. The first letter writer is hitting on a point about the economy, which is interesting, because I also heard a couple clips about the price of gas. Places dropping below $3. And rather than celebrating and saying, wow, you know, look, the current administration should get credit for this, it took too long. I mean, it's like no matter what you do, it doesn't seem to be enough. It's also this, I mean, one of the things that Trump gets an awful lot of credit for is his political acumen, which, again, I don't understand, because his record, I mean, just go back to his record, is of multiple failures. You know, if you look at everything from his casino to his university to his airline to his state company to his watches, it's a history of grift. But he certainly has created, and I don't know if it's because of that silly reality TV show that he was on, somehow he's a successful business person. I mean, the most successful thing he did was wait for his dad to die and inherit the money.
I just think that there's a halo effect to memory. People don't remember the bad stuff. They remember, you know, they can tell you right now that their groceries are a lot more than they were at some point, right, in recent history. And that's, you know, gas price might go up and down. The grocery prices aren't going down. Rents are not going down. And, you know, the whole global instability issue, whether or not he had anything to do with it, you know, it is something that is creating a sense of anxiety amongst people. And it is, I think it is relevant. But I think it's really, really hard to be from the same administration and shake off the track record, whether or not it's a good one. I mean, they could say all day long it's a good one. People still are grocery shopping every week, you know.
And the Democrats kept Kamala in the backstage area. They
Yeah, nobody knew her. And what people knew of her wasn't necessarily always positive. It was just sort of like, oh, she's not very nice, or so, you know.
Well, and especially for progressives, because she was a prosecutor. Like, this has been mismanaged for the entire election season by the Democrats.
I thought it was mismanaged from the moment he was elected president and he came running out on stage on the day that they finally announced Georgia. And she was five paces behind and off to the left and didn't speak. And to me, that sort of set the tone from the very beginning on that day in November of 2020.
I mean, that's the lived reality for women in America every day.
So we have to take a break, but I'll just leave with this question and then we'll come back to it. But I mean, I don't see a lot of people talking about it. I don't see a lot of people in the media talking about it, but I mean, a lot of this is just blatant sexism and racism, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I would even argue more sexism than racism, but let's talk about that when we come back. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable panel. Bob Griffin, Heather Mulligan, and Sarah Rogerson making up our panel this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. When I was watching the closing statement, if you will, the closing argument from Kamala Harris last night, made in Washington, D.C. in the Ellipse, I was struck by a point where she said, even though I've been your vice president for 4 years, I feel that many of you probably don't know me. And I thought, well, okay, but again, this gets into what we were talking about just before the break of, okay, but why don't a lot of people know you? And certainly, why don't people know you now? But also the story that's being written on the other side, the story that became loud and clear at the rally at Madison Square Garden, aside from the quote-unquote joke, was that, I mean, the word bimbo was used.
The devil.
The devil incarnate.
They called her handlers pimps, which makes her a prostitute.
Correct.
There's been this. I mean, Trump has called her stupid. I mean, back to Sarah's comment, which I think we need to go back to is there's a pattern here of attacking her. She's an accomplished woman, and it's the same vitriol, and I think this is what. I also intellectually struggle with is that if you're married, you have a daughter. If you're a woman, how can you not listen to this and say I can't support this? This is where I have this cognitive disconnect between the polls,
right.
And what's being said publicly and how people are reacting to it. And Joe, unfortunately, in a perverse way, the garbage can comment about Puerto Rico, which was just so offensive, shielded a lot of other really vile comments that people need to be called to task on.
Yeah, I agree. And by the way, the guy's obviously never been to Puerto Rico because it is a gem. I mean, if you go to Old San Juan, mm-hmm. there's castles that are from, I don't know what century, but a long time ago that are amazing. I mean, they are amazing. And I mean, it's a really spectacularly beautiful place. And I would urge people to take a chance and visit there because I've been multiple times and I love Puerto Rico. I would think about moving there if I didn't melt in the heat, but but it's a gorgeous place. I mean, there's rainforest, there's beautiful shoreline. It's really spectacular, and this incredible old city, Old San Juan, which is it's like it's right out of Europe. It's incredible. So, anyways, but the offensive, you know, characterization or anti-woman language is just. You know, it's awful, and it's awful that anyone would think that it's okay. to have these views of what is essentially more than half of the population of the country.
Well, I think they see it as it's not their women, it's that woman. And that's the difference, right? Like, patriarchy works that way. It infects men and women to say, don't believe what progress is telling you to be true. In order for you and your family to be safe, you have to keep them safe. You protect your daughter from the government. You are the ones that protect your marriage from any number of perceived threats, giving other people rights. You know, you're there to protect your land. It's an old, rugged, individualistic story of America that has started with colonialism and will not die. It is so attractive to lots of people who feel unsafe, who feel threatened, who feel aggrieved, that is what you hold on to. You hold on to your homestead, you hold on to your people against all threats. And that means that government can't help either. And government is actually the enemy. So why would I contribute to a woman in charge of the government when she can't help us either? Especially when she is probably going to face a lot of hurdles, well-documented hurdles, to being effective in a male-dominated structure, which Congress and the executive branch and the judicial branch, all three, still are.
Yeah.
I just don't, like, there's other countries around the world, including, you know, countries in the Southern Hemisphere, including in Europe, that have been governed by women for years, very effectively. Like, what's our problem? Seriously. Costa Rica elected a woman president more than a decade ago. And that is, you know, a Central American country, and a beautiful place also that I've been to many, many times. But like, how is it that we can't elect a woman president? I don't even understand why it's an issue.
Well, and especially if I could, I mean, you think about, you know, one of the greatest, arguably one of the greatest prime ministers in the United Kingdom since Churchill was a woman, right? Maggie Thatcher, Merkel in Germany. There's this perverse barrier. I'm going to toss another element on the table that I think needs a lot more conversation, and it's the disgusting amount of money coming from a small group of elites into this election that I think is potentially warping this country. And, you know, the position of the government can't, you know, making the government the enemy, particularly since the government is maybe one of the only institutions that can counterbalance the type of money and power that some of these men have, is a huge concern for me.
Well, and I had to refresh my recollection, but a lot of the women that you see, not all of them, not recently, but elected to these higher powers are conservatives. I think if we have a first female president, it will be a Republican woman.
It's possible, but I will say I think our primary system, and I said, what's wrong with us? But I do think our primary system is at least in part to blame. Because you have really the fringe control who can get elected, and you can't have a moderate. And there are certainly a lot of moderate women in politics that don't have a shot of making it through a primary.
Another mistake by the Democrats this cycle, because that is something that moderates and conservatives are seizing on to say they can't even elect anyone to their candidacy appropriately. The Democrats overthrew Biden with Kamala without procedural protections or procedural anything, which, of course, isn't true to a certain extent, but also really is. That's politics.
Well, it's clear that he didn't have these struggles like just arrive the day of the debate.
No.
So I think that it's the people around him who need to be, you know, held to account for not calling it soon enough. In time for the convention, at the very least. I mean, I thought for sure there would be a brokered convention or something different because, you know, it's obvious that problem predated that debate.
Coming soon to a bookstore near you after the election is going to be all the books about.
Yeah.
This is when we first noticed that Uncle Joe was starting to drift. Just a couple letters, and we'll go right over to the news. How can there be a closing argument when the campaign continues until Election Day? That's from Bob. Well, Bob, already 50 million people have voted. So, really, it's early voting, and it's the close of the campaign. So you do it now, or you don't really do it, because by the time...
It's too late.
Then you just have the people who are going to the polls. Also, we got this from, yes, Trump is a businessman, writes Elena. What seems to be escaping a large portion of population is that he's not a very good businessman. And we'll end with Charles, who says, okay, that's it. That's it for Jaime's Deli. From now on, I'm going across the street to Murray's Deli. By the way, Murray's Deli, their open-faced brisket melt. Oh my God!
Oh, you're killing me.
On the main line, Bala Cynwyd, and Jaime's is right across from Murray's there, so you can actually check out both. But thank you, Charles. We will take a break. When we come back, we will talk more about brisket and pastrami and corned beef and all kinds of good meats. And much, much more right after this. All right, back to the letters. Russ says, oh, my God, I cannot stand, shouty caps, stand commentators constantly talking about how the U.S. primary system only elects extremes within the party. Are you kidding me? Biden won the primary against multiple more progressive candidates. I understand there is an issue throughout the 24 campaign as Biden stepped aside after voting was done, but Harris was part of that campaign, and she has clearly moderated. She is not, shouty caps, extreme. She doesn't support Medicare for all, the Green New Deal, and she's not against the death penalty. Those, shouty cap, are progressive stances. Harris is running on none, shouty cap, of them. Ugh, shouty cap.
Wow.
I think it's important to note that she wasn't on the ballot for the primary.
Yes. Agreed.
Which was the point.
Yes,
that was the point.
It was.
Why do I feel I'm hearing a post-mortem, if not an autopsy report, on the roundtable this morning? Polls have been off in both directions, underestimating Democratic support in 2022. I'm holding out hope that North Carolina replaces Michigan and Kamala squeaks through.
Yeah, I mean, nobody knows, right? Yeah. We're not. There's no post-mortem. It's because... It's too close to call. It's just too close to call.
Other than our own.
Right. I mean, no, it's too close to call in every single swing state. That's the reality. And if you adjust for the last time that Trump was on the ballot, if you took those polling numbers at that point and you said, okay, the mistake is exactly the same mistake, he wins in a landslide. I mean, there's no question about it. He wasn't on the ballot in 22, but even if you correct for that, for those polling numbers, she needs to be up by like 4 to 5 points in order to win those states. So the polling tells us nothing. It tells us nothing.
It's never too early to identify mistakes that have already been made.
Correct.
Nobody who's voting for Democrats is going to be like, oh, you know what? You're right. There were some procedural deficiencies there. I'm going to vote for Trump instead. This is a learning moment, really. I don't mean to sound, I mean, I'm not the best teacher of this particular political dynamic, but it doesn't take a political analyst to see the mistakes that the Democratic Party made that put us all in the state of anxiety, fear. It's by design, not by the Democrats. It's by design by the Trumpers, and the Democrats fed it right into it by being indecisive.
I think the more the media, and I don't even want to say mainstream because I'm not sure what that means anymore, but the more the media attacks him, it seems to have a beneficial effect on him, which is very interesting dynamic. And I'm not sure I can explain that, but it does seem like every time they attack him, his popularity goes up. And he's not trying to win this election, in my view. I mean, he's got...
We had the best... I don't know. We had the best letter yesterday from a listener that said, if he was trying to lose the election on purpose,
right,
he couldn't.
What would he be doing different?
Right. Nothing. That's my point.
Yes. Yeah. It's a good point. I mean, it's just like, what else would you do? Like, if you're just trying to throw it...
Yeah, he's not trying to reassure anybody who's on the fence. Mm-mm. You know, everything that comes out is going to make people, like, turn away from him, you would think. But that's not been what's happening.
He's trying to scare the part of his base that doesn't want to vote that day or look into early voting. Or he's trying to that's their GOTV strategy, is fear.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about immigration and Trump's anti-immigrant message, which, as the New York Times writes, is exposing longstanding tensions. And this is, of course, also as a remnant of the event that happened at Madison Square Garden on Sunday in New York City, and exposing those tensions and challenging Democrats' hopes for solidarity. In the Democratic imagination, people of color is a unifying term, a label for a durable coalition of Black and Latino voters, as well as Asian Americans, Arab Americans, and Native Americans. Donald Trump is showing just how imaginary that unity might be. For months, the Trump campaign and its allies have effectively exploited divisions and bigotry within minority communities, pitting them against immigrants and each other. Mr. Trump's social media posts warn Black and Latino voters that immigrants are coming for their jobs. His promises to save cities that have been invaded and conquered are a feature of his rallies, including Sundays at MSG, where politicians have long stoked racial divisions to win elections. In many ways, these appeals to Black and Latino voters are not markedly different from those aimed at white voters. Your problems can be blamed on illegal immigration. Lack of affordable housing, stagnant wages, struggling schools, urban crime. Deportation is a single, seemingly simple solution that the argument goes. The us versus them framing has long characterized political alliances across the ideological spectrum, but Mr. Trump has been far more direct than any recent presidential candidate in inviting Black and Latino voters to be part of the us, so long as they acknowledge that there is a them. At the Trump rally at Madison Square Garden, a lineup of Trump campaign surrogates unleashed the most plainly anti-immigrant racist remarks of the campaign, notably while speaking to a crowd that was more racially diverse than most of Mr. Trump's rallies. That from the New York Times. Sarah.
I mean, it was in New York, so... statistically, right. It's going to be more racially diverse because this is where everybody immigrated. not everybody, and I should be very careful about that because there is forced migration by virtue of slavery. But that also happened in New England and on the East Coast. It's almost as offensive to paint quote-unquote people of color with a broad brush and expect a certain outcome at the polling place and not tend to the concerns that are raised by multiple groups representing multiple concerns and facets of the millions and millions and millions of actual individual people who comprise that group. I get very frustrated when... And we're going to have to be really careful after the election to talk about that, about race and politics in a more responsible manner. And that's not directed at you, Joe, or this article. It's something that bothers me a lot. What is clear, however, is that there are other options for handling the immigration issues that we face. Stephen Miller spoke for Trump, saying that America is for Americans and Americans only, which echoes is torn. It's language that was used in Nazi Germany. It just was. That's just a fact. It's now reported by multiple news outlets. That's not a conspiracy theory. That is a fact. And it's not a surprising fact for anyone who's been paying attention to immigration, because Stephen Miller's been saying these things since he was 20, in his 20s.
Right.
So, like, that's his thing. Ronald Reagan had another solution. Ronald Reagan, a Republican, some listeners might remember, granted amnesty to millions of undocumented immigrants in this country, and it boosted our economy. There are other options. But if you want to invest billions of dollars in trying to chase down people who go to your church, who clean your house, who take care of people that are sick in the hospital, who run businesses, who are professors, who are, you know, elite performers, then that's Trump's platform.
Which is, I mean, it's kind of interesting, too. I think, let's call it a little bit of more hypocrisy. If using Miller's comment about America's for Americans, like, so where does Melania Trump fit into that? And where does Elon Musk, who was not...
Well, he's from Canada, though, isn't he? Oh,
no,
he's from
South Africa.
Okay, because I was going to say, if he's
South
Canadian,
Africa,
that's America.
the Americas.
Canadian and now. I mean, it's really interesting to me how, you know, we don't spend a lot of time saying, you know, wait a second. What I mean, within your own, you know, your own sphere of influence... immigration has had a huge impact on your family, but all of a sudden it's not right for everybody else. And for everybody who's taking this, I mean, I would ask, go back and look at your own family heritage. Where did your people come from?
I think part of the point of the article was that, and one of the divisions that people don't recognize is that there are folks who emigrated here legally, and they, you know, don't align themselves with the people who are illegally crossing the border, even though they may be from the same country. And that's an interesting point that gets lost. Now, whose fault is that we don't have a workable immigration system? I mean, you can blame both parties, but I think the most recent effort was squashed by the person who's trying to become president again right now. So
Trump.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I think, you know, there's a lot of there's a huge mistake in lumping people together racially, saying all people of color should vote this way because, this nation has a very fine history of figuring out ways to divide people based on subcategories. I mean, look at the Irish need not apply, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're from the same part of the world as the English and the Scottish, and they were fine. So people tolerated it because it wasn't about them.
But there's this narrative, though, that that people came in legally. And I think we need to be really careful to remember the history is that the mass waves of immigration from Europe came before there were any laws in place.
Oh, that's true.
Okay,
correct.
So this idea that they came in legally.
No, I'm talking about people who came from South America recently, who went through the process.
I get it, but there's a washing of our own immigration history and how people were able to get here.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea that somehow, that if your ancestors came from Europe like mine did, well, they did it legally. No, they did it before there were any laws.
Yeah, right. There were.
There's also like a deep misunderstanding by the press about the border numbers and the number of people who are entering irregularly, because a lot of the statistics are down to very fine detail. Like border encounters are very different. You could have six, seven border encounters with the same person. And statistically, that makes the numbers look enormous when it's just one person. And how do you define an encounter? So there's also like a lot of misreporting around this issue, which doesn't help because honestly, we have our own selves to blame for the immigration situation in this country. If we had a collective will to solve it, we would have a long time ago. There is none.
There was a really good podcast on immigration. I think it was yesterday, New York Times, or maybe the day before. But The Daily had a really, really good sort of comprehensive history of immigration that talked about what you were saying, that you know, there was a time when there really were no rules. All you had to do was get here.
Yep.
I mean, there were some rules. They were really misogynistic.
Yeah.
You had to have you had to have somebody vouching for you.
Right.
But yeah, it was all made up.
In the initial laws were put in place, and Sarah, this is more your bailiwick than mine, but if I remember my history, it was because of the anti-Asian.
Correct. The Chinese Exclusion Act was one of the first major federal immigration bills. They're all built to exclude, not to regularize migration.
So the last 2 days have driven me absolutely nuts because...
Last 2 decades? What was it?
Well, no, I mean, this is basically just to add on to the pile, you know, and add it to the litany. But this conversation, and I just saw it 5 minutes ago, just looking up at the monitor where CNN is on, but they're still talking about the quote unquote joke that was told, and which is horrible. I mean, no question about it. It was horrible. It was one of 800 horrible things that were said at that time. My point is that we keep on looking at it over and over and over and over and over again. Many in the media, not all, many in the media are focusing on it as if it's going to change the election results. And it doesn't seem to me that we have then learned anything that if we're having that conversation over and over and over and over and over again of that. And to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, the only thing that was different about that event than so many of the other things is that the campaign put out a one sentence. We distance ourselves from that.
That's all they need to do.
Yeah. Well, and then Trump went back and said it was a love fest and didn't do anything and said he didn't see anything wrong with it. But so right. But that was more typical.
But there are a couple of issues here, though, Joe, that we can't ignore. One, people coming from Puerto Rico, they're American citizens. Okay, it's a territory. It's not; these aren't illegal immigrants. I mean, that I think gets lost. And if the comic in the Trump administration thinks that there are that many issues with Puerto Rico that we as a country owe it to clean that up.
Yeah, I just want to clarify. I am. What was said was repugnant and awful. Mm-hmm. My concern is about the press coverage as if it's the only
thing,
horrible thing that was said at the rally. And somehow it has been given a score system as this gets more points in vileness than all of these other things, like the aforementioned Stephen Miller and do you want to see these people in our country?
And I think this gets back to the earlier conversation we were having, too, is that this also sort of hides the base misogynistic position of the GOP's presidential candidate as well. I mean, yeah, I thought the comments about Harris, I think that, you know, the terminology that the comic was going to use to describe the vice president of the United States was absolutely foul. It was also language that I will note that Elon Musk had on an ad on X, which was quickly taken down. It was so outrageous that it actually hides a whole plethora of other sins that we shouldn't let slide.
Just imagine if the press was focused not on what was said at the rally and what was said at a debate and what was said somewhere else, but focused on, oh my gosh, look at the economic report. It's really great. Oh my gosh, gas prices that are at a low for, you know, and the supply chain disruptions are looking good right now. And I mean, I do think, like, the more bad stuff they say about him, the more the people who are already in his corner are like, look, they're trying to trump up all this stuff and I just worry, like, there was a rule a long time ago that you're not supposed to even say your opponent's name when you're speaking and you're running for office. And I mean, I don't know how you do that in this case, right, because of the character issues, but they're not news. It's not like we just woke up and found out, oh my gosh, he's, you know, got some different, you know, views of what is acceptable than the mainstream. Everybody already knew that. So, I mean, if we keep bringing that up, I don't know that it's helping her. And I think it might be helping him.
Yeah, the first time around, it was about misogynistic language and behavior. And then he was put on trial for assault.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean,
of a woman.
This is not news,
it's
right?
This country loves that stuff.
We're not talking about the fact that this guy is running for office to keep himself out of jail.
We're not.
No, and I mean,
talking about the trials or the much of the legal action that has been basically put on hold.
And all it took
has been put on hold.
All it took for the October surprise when Hillary Clinton ran was a letter. It was a letter.
Yeah.
Somebody wrote a letter.
Somebody in
power and authority, a federal agency wrote a letter, but still, like, there's a lot of federal agencies writing all kinds of stuff about Trump, and nobody cares.
None of it is a surprise. Yeah. None of it is news to us. I mean, I think he could actually go find someone's cat and eat it, and he's
on
still,
stage,
yeah,
at Madison Square Garden. Yep.
I mean, not well, fine. I don't mean fine in the sense acceptable. I mean, no. I don't think it would change anyone's opinion.
Well, you talk about the letter, but I mean, then Access Hollywood tape, and that didn't do anything.
Right.
I mean, that didn't have any effect.
Even though that was a surprise.
And then the press, the press was then immediately chastised after the election for giving him too much free airtime, putting on the rallies. But we're doing that. We're doing that this year.
We didn't
do it 4 years ago, but we're doing that this election cycle. Absolutely. Now, in fairness, CNN ran the Harris rally and they ran the Trump rally.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but man, that's hard. And then quickly people will say, as they say all the time, as they write to us, but they're not fact checking any of it. And right.
We know it's embellished. It's, I mean, again, it's all baked in now that we expect that. Yeah, there's going to be exaggerations. That's why when I saw the thing about Elon Musk saying they were going to cut $2 trillion from the budget, I just had this thought in my head of you know, gazillion trillion billion
gajillion dollars
gajillion dollars, like, you know, like,
well,
like, is it real? I don't know.
We'll talk a little bit about that when we come back. I would like to check in on that issue in just a moment. We have a wonderful panel with Sarah Rogerson, Heather Mulligan, and Bob Griffin. We're going to take a short break and hear news from the BBC. When we'll come back, we'll talk about Elon Musk, amongst other issues, and get your letters and wrap up for this Wednesday morning. We have about 15 minutes left with our panel this morning. I'm Joe Donahue, Sarah Rogerson, Bob Griffin, and Heather Mulligan making up our panel. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So we were mentioning Elon Musk before we went to break, and we're talking about, and we got to say gajillion dollars, which makes me really happy because that's just fun to say. Elon Musk appeared to acknowledge Tuesday that his pledge to help former President Donald Trump slash federal spending could unleash severe short-term economic turmoil, underscoring the fiscal stakes as voters weigh whether to send the Republican back to the White House. Musk first outlined his highly aggressive target at a campaign rally in New York last weekend, promising to identify at least $2 trillion in cuts as part of a formal review of federal agencies that he would conduct if Trump wins next week's election. But the audacious pledge, which drew rapt applause, belied a harsh fiscal reality, slashing the budget that steeply would require decimating an array of government services, including food, health care, and housing aid. And it could erode funding for programs that lawmakers in both parties say they want to protect, from defense to Social Security. By Tuesday, Musk appeared to acknowledge the economic risks of his own proposal on X, the social media site he owns. The tech mogul agreed with another user's post that argued his federal review and other Trump policies risked, quote, a severe overreaction in the economy, end quote, causing financial markets to tumble before the country's fiscal standing later improves. Heather.
Well, the real problem with the number, I mean, just in plain terms, is that discretionary spending in the federal budget doesn't even come to $2 trillion. It's $1.7 trillion. It's 21% of the federal budget. 61% is mandatory. So it's healthcare, it's Medicaid, it's school funding. The discretionary spending piece, you'd have to cut all discretionary spending altogether and then cut into some of the mandatory spending. And if you're saying in your head, like 61 plus 26% doesn't add up to 100, it's because the whole rest of it is interest on debt. And the federal debt is at an all-time high. So there's no way you cut $2 trillion from the federal budget without impacting Social Security, Medicaid. It's just not possible.
Right.
And there are regulations that govern all of those things. So presumably you would trigger a gajillion Administrative Procedure Act lawsuits or whatever else sort of claims would be out there to stabilize the economy. Probably also triggering some sort of like emergency budget measure that Congress could step in and enact in order to stabilize the markets. I mean, like,
markets are going to crash.
Just if we're worried about national security, discretionary spending, the largest category of discretionary spending is Pentagon and the military.
Yep. Yep.
So you'd have to eliminate that entirely.
Yep.
And all of the jobs that go with it. And for anyone who's listening, remember, too, that the farm subsidies, you know, because you see the big swath of red out in the Midwest, that basically the government has taken on a lot of the risk from agriculture, and we subsidize the crops. It will also do things like, kill SNAP and the social safety net. And I'll just remind, I'll remind the listeners that this is coming from the mind of a man who doesn't care, because he's got plenty of money and he's got his own security and military, and he's got his own, he's not going to go hungry. You know, it's not like if his kids get sick that he's not going to be able to fly them to the best doctors in the world, things that the rest of us aren't going to be able to do. It is more dangerous than I think people would like to let on. It sounds great, right? We're going to cut the federal government. You know, we're going to cut these services until you realize how many services most of the country depends on.
I think most people don't resent the services. I think that there's a view that there's a complexity that the federal government adds, but a lot of it is actually state added.
Let's unpack that for a second. If they're getting the benefit, that's something that they deserve. If somebody else is getting the benefit, that's a handout subsidy in their welfare cheese. I mean, we've created this really warped view of what the government does and what the government stands for. Yeah. And this goes back to, this goes back to Ford and all the way back into the 70s. And I think Reagan really played up on the whole idea of the welfare queen. And that has continued on and sort of hardened into the position that we see now.
Let's go to some letters that we're getting here, and we'll bring up the in the show that way. Although, was there anything? Oh, I wanted to talk about Aileen Cannon real quick.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Talk about the rotten cherry on the bad Sunday.
I just didn't know that was a thing, but here we go. Judge refuses to recuse herself from Trump assassination case. That's the headline in the New York Times. The man accused of plotting to shoot Donald J. Trump at his golf course had asked the judge to step aside, saying she had been praised by the former president and listed as a possible Trump appointee. Eileen Cannon, the federal judge overseeing the prosecution of a man accused of trying to assassinate former President Donald Trump, rejected the man's request that she remove herself from the case, saying on Tuesday that she had no relationship with Mr. Trump, even though he appointed her to the bench, and she has ruled in his favor in a separate criminal manner. Judge Cannon denied the request by the defendant, Ryan Routh, in a brief decision issued in federal district court in Fort Pierce. In federal district court in Fort Pierce, Florida, Mr. Routh was arrested last month in West Palm Beach after Secret Service agents spotted him carrying a rifle in the bushes along the fence line of one of Mr. Trump's golf courses. This is like one of those.
The world
is a small place, right?
But I mean, the fact that she's a Trump appointee, it's not like he met with her and said, "Oh, you're awesome. I want you to always rule in my favor." And now the fact that she did previously rule in his favor.
Did we know he didn't do that?
Yeah.
No, come on. That's not how it works. It's not. It's like the state senators make the recommendations. And I mean, there's a gets approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee. But I mean, to say that someone can't preside over a case because of the party or the individual that appointed them, to me, is just a tempest in a teapot. It's nothing. Right. That's not. The interesting thing is that she's previously ruled in a case and there's some implication or that she's somehow biased in his favor. But I don't think she was overturned. I'm not sure if she was overturned or not. But this is this is a defense attorney maneuver trying to deflect from the fact that his client was hiding in the bushes with a rifle. Maybe I don't know what else he could have been doing, like flamingo hunting
It is Florida, so I'm not sure that's quite as unusual as you think.
Okay.
But there are recusal rules, and that's they're arguing it in the papers and it's a headline for good reason.
Right.
I mean, it's an important story. I learned about it because I found out my kids were asking these really sophisticated questions about the election and about this judge. And I was like, where are you guys getting all this information? And they're like, well, we have to get through the headlines to play Wordle.
Well, that's cool.
Is it? They're, you know, they 11 and 14.
That's how we get them.
If you just get the New York Times game app, you don't have
to
do that.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And you can play past Wordle games.
I had no idea they were playing Wordle. You know, everybody's worried about Roblox.
I got it in two yesterday. I'm sorry.
So did my 11-year-old, apparently.
Okay.
It's America's obsession. But the idea, I mean, first of all, I mean, I guess I think of it as two ways. One, okay, but you, if you're trying to kill the president of the United States, you know, this case, you have a federal judge who's overseeing the case, and I'm sure will be fair in that regardless. Although I could also quickly say, is it really hard to find another judge that would be able to do that? But I understand.
Is this really going to trial? I mean,
well, that's the thing.
These are pre-trial papers,
yeah.
You know.
Right.
It's also a random selection.
It's not like she said, "Oh, give me this case."
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, you can't imagine anybody who's like wants to do this.
No. I don't know. There is
the appointee.
He's
angle.
A victim, she's going to save him, and then she could be appointed to the Supreme Court.
But there is, I mean, I think the bigger issue though is the lack of confidence that people have in the judiciary. You know, I was listening to Elon Musk, and I was thinking about, you know, Sarah, your comments about, you know, all these court cases. And all I can think of is that, you know, Clarence Thomas is sitting there saying, well, I need a new RV, so good timing, right? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, and all I can think of is the illegitimacy of the court and the lack of faith that I have in particularly in the Supreme Court.
By the way, who's seen those cyber trucks?
Oh,
they're
yeah.
so ridiculous.
There's
they
a couple
look like,
around here.
They look exactly like something my oldest son drew in like third grade. I was like,
and Geico won't insure them now because they don't. They're uninsurable.
These are the Musk,
the Elon Musk,
the Cybertrucks.
Cybertrucks. Yeah.
There's more around. I mean, I've seen quite a few of them.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, well, but
maybe
don't
we'll
they...
see Clarence Thomas driving around
in a Cybertruck.
Maybe.
Oh, all right.
Elon's going to be, what, Secretary of Treasury, apparently?
I know, this is not what we're here to discuss, but how is it determined to be a truck?
I don't know.
It's got an open bed in the back.
Does it? I don't think it does. It looks like a tank.
It's got, well,
it must, like, flip open somehow.
Yeah, yeah,
I think it's like an SUV, like they mean a truck.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think who drive actual trucks like 4x4s would call that.
I have a pickup
truck
and I would not call it a truck.
There you go.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Like this is a space vehicle or something.
But there are trucks that aren't pickup trucks. They don't have to have an open bed. You know.
Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Our new John DeLorean.
Yeah.
All right. Fun little fact. I don't know. We have 30 seconds.
We digress.
I'll just share this. But I was doing so. I remember as a kid going through Flemington, New Jersey, and Flemington, New Jersey had this entire army of just a huge field filled with DeLoreans in the 80s. And that was where they brought from Belfast, all the DeLoreans that were built in Belfast came mm-hmm. in and got parked in New Jersey. And then that's where they were distributed. The reason they were brought to New Jersey was because John DeLorean had this huge mansion that he lived in before he went to jail.
No.
Yeah. I thought it was in New Jersey, a place where dead things were lived.
So then DeLorean Motors went down the tube, even with the plus of Back to the Future, to drive sales. He goes to jail. And a lot of back and forth, gets out, goes back, moves into the mansion again. Things go downhill, sells the mansion. That mansion is Bedminster.
Oh.
The
fun fact.
The Trump Golf Club.
Wow. I actually rode in a DeLorean once when I was like 15.
They're fun, right?
It's like being in a plane, kind of. Yeah. It is. It's very.
What did you do in 1957? All right. We are done. My thanks to everybody. You're all wonderful, and I appreciate you being here. We'll be back right after this.